Thank you, Frieda. Okay, it's tough to be the last person and follow those great talks, but I'll try to do that. What I thought I would try to talk about today is the use of some national workers' compensation data sets and some state compensation data sets to understand miners' health. This is our group of colleagues at the University of Illinois where this work is based. The main funders for this is the Alpha Foundation for the Improvement of Mining Safety and Health that put a lot of support into this work, and we also have done some work for MSHA and for the U.S. Department of Labor Office of Workers' Compensation Programs. So this is the title of our project for the that was funded by the Alpha Foundation. I see David Wegman here, who is part of the board of that, so hopefully he'll like this talk. But anyway, we wanted to try to look at the structure and content of a lot of these data systems that really were not designed for public health reasons, but were designed for administrative reasons, and we're seeing that with a lot of the workers' compensation data sets. I'm struck by the state of Washington, how wonderful that situation is compared to many other states where the workers' compensation data is very difficult to access and to analyze. But we thought we'd look at that, and especially at some of the national data sets as well. One of the data sets that's never been analyzed before is the U.S. Department of Labor's Office of Workers' Compensation, Division of Coal Mine Workers' Compensation, which is the Black Lung Program, or the Black Lung Benefits Program. And it's a huge federal program that the data has never really been reviewed or analyzed at all for public health reasons. And I think there was a perfect storm of wonderful funding because of the Alpha Foundation, plus sort of a big Center for Public Integrity investigation into the Black Lung program that resulted in a Pulitzer Prize winning series that really shone a light on bad lawyers, bad doctors, and not that the government was doing a bad job, but the program received a lot of scrutiny, so for the first time ever, they opened up their data for us to take a look at. And then I'll also just talk about some of our state workers' comp work, and I'll mention a little bit about some of the NIOSH work that the Division of Respiratory Disease Studies, now called the Respiratory Health Division at NIOSH, has been doing. But usually it takes a major disaster to help free up funding and to do things and result in public health regulation and laws, money. Otherwise, if someone isn't really brutally murdered in a very obvious fashion, it's difficult sometimes to get attention. And so the Upper Big Branch disaster in West Virginia, in which a fire and explosion killed 29 miners, most of them from carbon monoxide, but other horrible things that happened, really resulted in a settlement between the U.S. attorneys and the company, which was Massey and then bought by Alpha. By the way, you might be following the Blankenship trial, where the CEO of Massey Energy is on trial for criminal charges, which is kind of interesting. But anyway, we'll see if he goes to jail. That would be quite nice. I'd be pleased. But the Alpha Corporation bought this property and then got sort of stuck with the liability and gave us the money for this. And it's a joint project between University of Illinois, National Jewish Health, dear colleague Cecile Rose, Rutgers University, and West Virginia University, Lee Petzonk. And these are the data sets that we really tried to look at. MSHA maintains a lot of data on production and mining and has some data on mines in terms of the types of mines. And they do have some reporting nationally similar to the OSHA 300 system that Dr. Fagan was talking about. They have the Part 50 program. And I talked about the federal Black Lung program. And then NIOSH has wonderful data, but mostly on active miners, working miners, and not a lot on people who've left the industry, which is really something that we suffer from a lot in so many of our studies, is that former workers or people that have left for all sorts of reasons are not studied. In terms of our state-based collaborators that we try to look at state data sets, We mainly ended up working with the Illinois data set, where Linda Forrest, who's also in the audience, is a PI on a project where we actually manage the data for the state of Illinois, which is very helpful. We tried to work with Colorado. I was interested to see our colleague here from Colorado who had some great data, but from one company. But the state system is really not designed to give great data, unfortunately. So if you have the opportunity to work with one provider, then it's helpful, but otherwise it was difficult. And West Virginia was a political nightmare to try to get data from them. I won't go through it, but it's sort of now a whole privatized morass of very difficult situations. So our data from West Virginia, we actually got a letter from the governor's office saying that they refused to work with us because it was just too much work to do that, and they didn't think it was in their mission to provide data to analyze public health things. So, oh well. So we're sort of so I would like to provide on the successful part of this. I mean, part of the whole project is really struggling to see what are all these barriers and make recommendations to these different systems and see how they could be used to carry out their own mission, but also help us understand the health of these populations, not just administer claims. So the Department of Labor was wonderful, and this is their Black Lung Program, and they provided us all this data that they never really stored in a very easy-to-look-at data set. They had 50,000 records in a claims data set that was just the names and demographics. And then they had these Word documents that were summaries by claims examiners of huge amounts of medical evidence in a claim, but it was sort of done systematically so that we could take the Word document and abstract information into a database. It was grueling. Luckily, I didn't have to do that because I'm a pulmonologist, but we had wonderful epidemiologists and all you kind of wonderful public health people doing that. It was great. But we were able to get data from physical exam, from blood gases, from lung function tests, and from chest x-ray reports. The DOL MSHA data was excellent because they have really good data sets on sampling and surveillance and mine characteristics that was actually fairly useful. And NIOSH's data is really quite well organized, and so it was sort of wonderful to work with. The Department of Labor, when we took those 50,000 claims, we found that they were from 25,000 miners because these guys often file claims repeatedly in their efforts to get black lung benefits over the years. And we looked at about 13, 14 years of data, and then we looked at the medical data that I'm showing you here. Just to note that we're seeing actually resurgence of black lung disease in the United States, and we're seeing a lot of people that were mining these narrow seam coal mines and developing a lot of disease. There's a lot of silica exposure in these mines, not just coal, and we're seeing this rapidly progressive pneumoconiosis, which is a huge problem. We found that the average age of the miners in the black lung program was over this 14-year period was about 62 years, and some quite older folks were in there as well. And I don't know how well the 21-year-old did in filing his or her black lung claim, but probably not that well. But substantial amounts of work. The 10 years were 24 years, so folks are working pretty much their whole working careers in this industry. And we were able to look at 25,000 pulmonary function tests. We found a fair amount of abnormality. The problem is trying to find a nice unexposed group of people to use as a control group, so I'm really just going to report on the proportion of people with these findings in these data sets. So 8.3% had obstructive lung disease, a large percentage, nearly a third, with the restrictive impairments, and then another 14% with mixed patterns. But 20% of this population, and this is fairly objective testing, met criteria for moderately severe or worse impairment, less than 60% of reference values, which is what you have to get in order in the Black Lung Program to be considered disabled. So 20% of the population by lung function was disabled, although the claim success rates for the Black Lung Program is much less than that, somewhere around 10%, 7 to 10%. One of the things we tried to look at was what was the patterns over time between the institution of modern dust control regulations, which happened in 1970, again, after another major disaster, versus miners that worked before that time. So we looked at people that could never have worked under anything but modern dust controls and those that worked before. And we found that that there was a little less obstructive lung disease, a little bit more restrictive lung disease post-regulation miners, and a little bit less of the mixed impairments. So we're seeing a little bit less of obstruction, and when we actually we looked also at the amount of severe impairment, and we found that the severe impairment group also declined from pre-dust regulation to post-dust regulation, indicating that lung function improved a little bit. What we haven't completed yet is our analysis of what happens from people that worked only after the 90s, say, when we saw a resurgence of disease. We'd analyzed the smoking data, which I didn't show you here, but that showed that there was a much lower percentage of ever smokers in the post-regulation miners. So the population is smoking less, which may explain in part some of the improvement in lung function. We then looked at the x-ray findings in this group, and we found that a large percentage were positive for pneumoconiosis of all x-rays, 40%. But we saw an interesting pattern that they became less positive as they were reread, and that's part of that adversarial litigation process where the miner may have an X-ray read by a claims examiner, an examiner for the Department of Labor, and then the industry will get it reread by someone who is maybe an adversary of that person, and then it was often read as negative. And that happened as well for progressive massive fibrosis, the most severe form of pneumoconiosis, that they were read as positive and then reread as negative. And this just shows you those percentages before and after. And this so this is looking at the most recent X-ray, so the one that would be the most conservative finding for people that worked exclusively after the regulations compared to those that worked some of their time before the regulations. And we can see, somewhat scary, in the Department of Labor data that the rate of positive X-rays is increasing in people that worked after only after the regulations. And that's very similar to what NIOSH has seen in surveillance data, and that is that we're seeing resurgent pneumoconiosis, and we're seeing severe and advanced disease in young minors. And this is reflected in this Department of Labor black lung claims data. And again, we're using the conservative second readings of these X-rays to make these evaluations. And you can see that the rates increased from 3.3% proportion of minors with that compared to 5.8% for people that worked only after the dust regulations. So lung function seemed to be getting a little bit better, and X-rays are worse. I won't go into that. So I think that overall, it's still early days in terms of our evaluation of this literature. We have some modeling that we'd like to do and other work, but we are able to get some information from this that hasn't been really available before. In terms of Illinois workers' comp, we've been able to take Illinois workers' compensation claims, which is an indemnity system and a database that only includes cases where there's actually disagreement. And so if there's settlement, these claims are not there. So these tend to be more serious claims. And we looked at those for mining-related claims, that companies that showed up in that database as mining companies, compared to non-mining-related claims from 1990 to 2010. And then we're linking it to MSHA data as well. And we found that for mining-related claims compared to non-mining-related claims, after we matched all the company names to the MSHA database, that's how we made certain that they were mining-related companies. This is not just coal mining, but it includes quarries and aggregate industry as well. That many more heart and lung disease associated claims in miners compared to non-miners. Respiratory was a much greater finding in mining populations than non-mining populations. And certainly the finding of actual diagnosis of pneumoconiosis, while it was quite rare, was seen much more commonly, almost exclusively in mining related claims. We also looked at the differences between metal and non-metal miners and coal miners. And we saw that really in Illinois, the vast majority of mining-related claims in Illinois are related to the coal industry, as opposed to these metal non-metal mines and aggregate industry. And only 2% of the metal non-metal company claims were related to cardiopulmonary injury or illness. So a lot of disease coming from the coal mining industry. This is just the some of the characteristics of the claims for mining versus non-mining employees, and you can see that that non-mining claims are many more women, and that the age range was a little bit older in the mining-related claims. And there, as you see at the bottom, the cardiopulmonary, respiratory, and pneumoconiosis information. And we looked at the mine factors that were associated with cardiopulmonary illness. You can see that coal was a risk factor for having a cardiopulmonary injury or illness compared to non-coal. Male was a more significant factor. Age was a greater risk factor for a cardiopulmonary injury or illness. And interestingly also was that mine size was associated with a higher odds ratio when it was a smaller mine. And this also mirrors NIOSH data showing that small mines tend to have less health and safety infrastructure and fewer are unionized, fewer have health and safety committees. And actually the presence or absence of a safety committee was associated with claims as well, which we thought was a very interesting finding in mining-related claims. That if there was a safety committee, then it was less likely to have a claim for cardiopulmonary injury and illness. This is a mine that was in southern Illinois, showing you a roof bolter, which these guys have a lot of silica exposure. And I think I'm going to stop there. This last study is now published, and so that you can read about that. But we looked at some NIOSH surveillance data looking at chest X-ray relationship to lung function, which has always been thought that, I'll just show you the cover of it, it has always been thought that simple pneumoconiosis is a benign disease and doesn't result in lung function impairment, and at least that's what I was often taught in medical school. But we analyzed the data from several thousand workers from the NIOSH Co-Workers Health Surveillance Program and showed that even when you control for tenure, control for smoking, control for BMI, that the actual presence of these scars is not benign, but that it is associated with worsening lung function parameters. And so that that was a very useful analysis from that data set. So I think that I'm close to... Am I close to my stop here? We gotta have 10 minutes for questions. So I will stop there. One of the things that we're planning on doing with this data is we are now going to, for the first time in history, get two government agencies, well, not the first time, but for a very rare time. But we are actually linking NIOSH surveillance data with the black lung data from the Department of Labor, which has never been done. And then we'll really see people who showed up while they were actively mining and then see what happened to them at the end of their careers when they applied for black lung benefits. And we are going to link all these data sets with the National Death Index to do the first really largely denominator-based study of what happened to people who were coal miners in the past. NIOSH does its work for the work-related lung disease surveillance report, it's only whoever got coded as black lung or silicosis or asbestosis, but here we'll look at the death path, the mortality data on anyone that ever applied for black lung or ever showed up in surveillance data sets. So we're excited about those future studies. Thank you very much.
We'll take your questions now.
Yeah, I have some questions or observations about Natalie Bradshaw. Easier for me too, but I wanted to get clearer on some of the factors or metrics that your study employed in terms of definition of psychosocial factors of work and job health culture. As health and safety director for a labor union, I interact a lot with workers, and work-related stress is often mentioned as the most significant problem that they have. And the kind of things that are mentioned are understaffing, layoffs, job redesign, two people doing the job of three, unrealistic work demands, fear of retaliation, job loss, hours cut back, plant closing, those kind of things. So I'm wondering, related to that, of course, there have been a lot of studies about the less control workers have over their job and the higher demand, the greater level of stress. So were some of those factors taken into account?
I wish that that was in our survey, but we don't have that data. We just have health risk assessment data, which had that one question related to job culture. And then work comp data obviously didn't have that. But I completely agree, those would be extremely important factors.
You also have one slide that said that the finances were mentioned 63% of the time as classification of stress and work 31%.
Yeah.
It would seem to me if workers' wages are insufficient, they're stagnant in relation to inflation, if they don't work enough hours, if that's really finance that's work-related, and I'm just wondering how that breakdown between finance and stress was determined.
That's a good question. So there are three separate questions related to stress, and they were just simply, I can't remember the exact wording, but it wasn't as specific as you're asking, but it does say, are you feeling often stress related to finances? Are you often feeling stress related to home life? Are you related to work? But yeah, there's that
question. Did you collect your salary, your wages?
Yeah, we control for it, yeah.
No, not control for it. Can you report on what their wages were related to, whether they had stress about financial issues?
I could. I don't have that off the top of my head, though, but I can follow up with you.
A question and a comment. The question is, who funded the work?
Pinnacle Insurance.
Okay, so the insurance company funded that. Okay, just wanted to clarify that. What I felt was, hearing your presentation and then Kathy's presentation, that they can't exist in the same world, but the universe has just exploded. Where I'm coming from, again, from a labor union perspective, is that all injuries and illnesses in the workplace are the result of exposure to hazards and hazardous conditions. And where this is taking us is kind of an extension of the blame the worker philosophy. We've seen that a lot around safety issues in the workplace. If you get injured, it's your fault because you weren't careful enough or whatever. In the meantime, the conditions were exactly what you heard, you know, too few people doing too much work, way too many hours, workload intensification, all of that kind of stuff, plus the other kind of hazards. And now there's this whole move to look at health and now bring kind of workers' comp into the picture and say, well, you got that injury, but it's not really because there was a hazard there. We want to look at, you know, you're not eating right, you're not sleeping right, you know, you're overweight, and it's a very, very dangerous path. And I think everyone here should really think about this HRA now that's out there, and in the workplace you get, you know, benefits if you fill out the HRA, or you can get punished if you don't. But where is that information going? It's going into a study that says in workers' comp, what we have to do is focus on the worker and their personal attributes, not the hazards in the workplace. And I would invite, you know, I'm just thinking about if I can get you into some of the workplaces where we represent to show you a different picture than Ron Gethol is going. Because I think that there is a rich debate and discussion that we're not going to be able to have here, maybe at 12:30 tomorrow, and we're going to be talking about this in another workshop, but there does need to be debate and there does need to be discussion. I think it's a very dangerous path for workers to have this kind of research that's taking us into blame the workers now in a different arena.
I think that's certainly a valid point. I completely respect that perspective because in the wrong hands, this data could be used pretty poorly, I can imagine. But I think that the injury model is more complex than we think. And I know in my own research agenda, I will not be solely focusing on blaming workers and their health as the cause of their injury. And I do think it's important for us, and we will be, to continue to look at this multi-level model. It's obviously just not the results of the worker. I can't speak for Pinnacle, but I know they don't think that too, and we're in the process of incorporating more data than just health risk assessments. We're going to be looking at safety audit data, et cetera, and looking at work comp outcomes. So.
That's the debate
again.
Yes. Yes, sir.
Well, so I just want to maybe step over the academics to talk about this way, but I think there are variations in claim filing behavior. And there are analytical techniques like propensity scores and other things that you can kind of look at that. And I won't even go into that. Obviously, one of the biggest predictors of filing a claim is whether somebody filed a claim previously. But and there's just a huge literature on that, so you don't need to reinvent the wheel. But I think I also would say that it's very important when you start to venture into this area that you have a well-conceived conceptual model of the relationships here, and you're trying to look for data that actually is sufficiently robust to begin to address that. So some of the comments that were made about measurement of stressors, self-perception of stress in a workplace is strongly associated with exposure to stressors. That people can be exposed to all sorts of stressors and not necessarily perceive stress. So they're both important, but yeah, focus on the underlying. Also, some of these issues in terms of obesity, well, there's literature on stress-related activity and lack of physical activity and other kind of things like that. So you need to think, sorry to use the jargon, but whether you want to use GAG diagrams or causal modeling or visceral modeling or this or that, you have to think about causal modeling that doesn't just take everything as a proximate cause and put it in there, but begins to ask, you know, what's the relationship between work and some of these other factors that you're thinking of as personal factors. So I'm sorry, I'm lecturing here. I apologize for that, but I'm just saying, I think a buffer against the danger of venturing in that area is to make sure you're driven by a clear conceptual model and understand that a lot of these personal risk factor things are functions of socioeconomic class and, in fact, can derive from workplace conditions, not the other way around. Sorry for being preachy, but it is a very dangerous slope that you're on.
Okay, we literally have 1 minute left, so you can take the last.
I have a question for Dr. Fagan. It's a big issue in terms of people really practicing outside their range of expertise. How do you think we can get a handle on this? I mean, is legal action possible? I mean, those laws vary state by state, I assume. That,
yeah, they do.
I mean, progress was made on asbestos, really, from a legal point of view. In terms of, and I'm wondering how you think the best way to approach that is.
Right. So, yeah, you know, it's how when we did this one case, and we didn't want to blame LPN because they really didn't see it. They didn't understand it. You know, they're being, and so I really think that we need to be talking all together and figuring out, well, what is the best practices for these kinds of, you know, they could be used really nicely, you know, to really help occupational health and safety in the workplace. So I think we need to all talk together. And you're right. States are all different, and things are changing. You know, physical therapists can now practice independently in every state in the union. And that could be great, but, you know, I'm a doc, so I could. But we need to be talking about this so that we're all, you know, working together for the right stuff. So that, I think, just talking and figuring it out and figuring out some best practices may be one of the ways. Legally, I don't know. I mean, OSHA can't, it's really a little outside OSHA's purview, but we're, you know, the medical management, the hazard alert letters may help. We can't, OSHA can't directly do legal action against how medicine's practiced.
Right.
Yeah. I had heard in the past that the American College of Occupational Environmental Medicine was looking at this, but then we heard that they got this. So, but that's the problem.
Linda, you have something?
No,
okay. Okay. Well, thank you so much.